Order for Wednesday, February 6th of 2008. Welcome, members, as we stagger to a start here. We have two items on our agenda for this afternoon. One is to see if we can complete the work on House Bill 3600, and the second will be an informational meeting update on the shared responsibility model. And Representative Comp is putting together a modeling portfolio, and so we are going to...
Gesture? Just a moment. I don't want to show the gesture on film when I'm...
You're supposed to be gesturing to me so that, because this is a live deal.
Oh, that's a live deal.
So it's on the camera.
Okay, very good.
Just like gesture with all your fingers showing?
We have students in the room, so please be careful.
I'm going to just move away from that and open a work session on doing the public hearing.
It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3600 just to see if anybody wishes to have further public comment on House Bill 3600. Seeing no one who wishes to comment, I'm closing the public hearing. I'll open up a work session on House Bill 3600. Members, our committee administrator has placed in your packet for today the Dash 2 amendment, which was discussed towards the end of yesterday's session. I'm calling it the Bennett Amendment, given Mr. Bennett's comments at the end of the hearing yesterday.
Mr. Chair?
It got longer.
Representative. So Dash 2 Amendment include the Dash 1 Amendment, right?
It incorporates, yes.
Incorporate, that's what I mean.
Version of the Dash 1.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yes. Thank you, Representative.
So I would... Dana, going to go through the...
The provisions of the amendment?
Sure. I'll speak to the Dash 2s.
Yes,
please. That would be helpful.
The first two elements of the Dash 1s are described and carried forward in the Dash 2s. Those provisions remove the contractor from the process of granting waivers for specific groups of students and specify that the 2008-2009 academic year is the year for which districts with an existing contractor with a contractor other than the one selected by the department may receive funding. The new piece in the Dash 2s is the following. It would permit the department to grant a waiver if the district's assessment meets the purpose and criteria of the assessment administered by the state-selected contractor. It requires waivers to districts who had a contractor in the 06-07 academic year for the assessment, and that assessment, again, must meet the purpose and criteria of the assessment administered by the state-selected contractor. And I can do that more in prose if it's helpful, but that's the gist.
I was just trying to...
That was well done. Thank you, David. Are there questions on the amendment, the Dash 2 amendment?
Kim, we have a moment to kind
absolutely
of go through it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do have a question.
Very good. Would you like to ask a question of Ledge Council, or would you like to, or do we have Ledge Council here?
Yes.
Very good.
Yesterday in the Health Committee, we had a discussion on what shall and... May and may not.
Mm-hmm.
May, but this is a new one. It says may and then it says only. Does that mean it's not a shall? It means they may or they may not, but if they decide to, they can only do it under these conditions?
Where are you looking?
I'm sorry, I'm looking at the Dash 2s, line
3, 6,
and, yeah, line 6. Yeah. Which says the department may grant a waiver only if. Now that means, does it mean, and may not, we learn, means they shall not. And shall means they must, and may means they can. So does this mean that they're not required to grant a waiver, but if they do grant a waiver, they can only do it under these conditions?
For the record, I'm Hannah Lai, Legislative Counsel. Yes. First, what you have to have happen is those conditions need to be met. Once those conditions are met, then the department has the discretion to grant the waiver.
I thought we wanted them to grant the waiver if these conditions were met, and it was requested.
That's
what I'm
what happens.
That's not what it says here.
You make an excellent point, Representative Greenlee, that it does seem to be saying that the department is not obligated to, but it is permissive for the department to do so. So it's Morgan, would you like to come join us? And let's hear from the department on this. Somebody tells me if the department did not grant a waiver after all the discussion we've had on this issue, the department would be filled with unhappy people, I think.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Morgan Allen, Department of Education, and the new Ledge Council can kick me under the table if I'm incorrect. But our read of this particular amendment would require the department to grant a waiver if the district contracted in the 06-07 school year and it met the requirements laid forth in the bill. We may also grant a waiver to a school district if they meet the conditions in the bill and they didn't have a contract in 06-07. So it's I read a mandatory waiver for 06-07 contract and a discretionary waiver if a district came and said, well, we have a contract, had a contract in 05-06 or whatever other reason they presented to us for a waiver, as long as it met the requirements laid out in the bill, we could give them a waiver. So I think it accomplishes what you wanted. It gives the waiver to the folks you...
Mr. Hill?
I'm sorry, Representative McFadden.
Where does that interpretation come from in terms of the common words of the...
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, again, LC can kick me under the table. I'm looking at lines the 11 through 14 on the bill.
Page 2. Which we're deleting.
The department shall grant a waiver under this subsection. And then I believe the words at least 95% were stricken from that. So that was the change that I thought I heard the committee desire.
Is it dash two? Is it back in?
I thought we were doing something about that 95%.
It's not in the amendment here.
On line 12.
What? Yep. Line 11 takes out the 95%.
Okay, it was on line 12 at the bottom of the amendment.
Takes out the 95%.
Yeah,
right.
But that section is still in under the dash two amendments. That section does not go away.
Well, but the may only, again, listening to the style of the may only means you may not do it unless these conditions are met.
Correct.
That's correct.
You said you had discretion to do it even when they weren't met.
No, let me clarify, Chair Buckley, Representative Green, that we shall and have to grant a waiver if those conditions are met and there was a contract in place in 06-07. We may grant a waiver if those conditions are met and there was some other circumstance, say a contract in 04-05 or 05-06. We may grant a waiver.
Right. So, Rather.
Yeah, to clarify, the conditions we're talking about here are the conditions on the front page, not the conditions of whether they did it the time before. So what that first portion that may grant only if, then we go back and look at those conditions on the front page that indicate that it does all these different things. That's the conditions that you're talking about. So as I read it, I think I have it the same way. If a school district that has never contracted before and would like to do it for 1 year, different from what we're doing it, and they pick a contractor that meets those on the front page, the district, the ODE can or may let them do it. The other part of that, if a district requests a waiver and they had a contract the previous year for any number of students, then you shall. I mean, you have no choice in that matter. They get grandfathered in. Other people can do it for a year if they want, the way it's written now.
Representative Greenlick said, is that an explanation for you?
No, I think the problem is we're putting in a Section B, which talks about they can only do it under certain circumstances. And then we still have Section C, which we're not deleting under this clause. So it says the department shall grant a waiver under this section if the entity which the school district has contracted administrator's assessment to grade 10 students during the 6-7 year and the assessment meets the requirements of paragraph B of this subsection.
Right.
Paragraph B being what?
Being the new B that's on the dash 2.
On your dash 2.
And it says, again, may only... I mean, I think we just build in some real confusion with B and C on the same... And when you build in confusion and ambiguity, you only enrich attorneys. Which I'm in favor of since my son's an attorney.
That's right, there we go.
So I guess I have a conflict of interest here.
Play that.
Representative Greenlick, would you like to see this amendment incorporated into a draft, a full draft of the text of the bill? Would that be They could begin to do a hand and gross version for you.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would encourage us to do that. I don't think the committee's going to work. We're going to work this thing, and this is going to be our bill. The two individuals of interest in this bill have said, you know, I think we're close to what they can agree to, so let's see if we can clean this up and make this perfectly clear for the Department of Education. Okay. I would be in favor of that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Thompson?
I totally concur with that proposal, Chair Buckley, and because when I left here yesterday, I thought C was completely out, and now knowing that they're kind of blended and mixed, I don't really know what I'm voting on.
You would like to see the text. Would that be possible for us to accomplish? We will get that done then. We'll have it written out. And if I can check with the committee, the issue being brought up, which wasn't discussed yesterday in my memory, of the ability for the department to grant a waiver for schools other than that had the test in 2006-2007. I just want to make sure the committee comfortable with giving the department that discretion. If not, I'd like to hear from the committee now so that I don't have it.
What did you just say?
Right now, a issue is being brought up, which you haven't discussed before, of having the department have the ability under the permissive notation you mentioned, Representative, that if there is a situation of a district having a test other than the 2006-2007 school year, that they had the discretion to allow a waiver. And that was not something we discussed. The department has, I think, just brought it forward saying that they would like to have some discretion in case of a different circumstance, but I want to make sure that circumstance or that discretion is all right with this committee.
Can we step back just a moment because you're confusing me a little further and making sure we understand what it is we're trying to achieve.
Okay.
And let's not talk about the words. What we're trying to achieve before today was to require a waiver in the conditions that there is a contract to deliver an exam that's been delivered in the 2006-2007 school year. There isn't any May in there, right?
Correct.
Now we're saying that and is there anything else in there? Are there any other Mays besides that?
No.
The other, what I'm bringing up is the department has brought
up. No, I mean up till now.
No.
Before you end now. So what we're trying to achieve here is the department must, if a district asks for it, of course, and it meets the criteria that it has a contract in place and it's already administered in the 06-07 year. That language ought to be simple and it ought to be not the way it is, I think, now. But now you're saying a second one, they may, not must, allow a waiver. Under any conditions?
Under different conditions. That is the with the department. Mr. Morgan, correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, first I'll say the department would be comfortable with either just the one mandatory waiver or if you wanted to give us mandatory and discretionary. We could live either direction. But the way the bill's written right now, we see two possible scenarios. Scenario A is, and I'm just going to use hypotheticals, the department contracts with the college board and school district X comes to us and says, in the 2006-2007 school year, we used an ACT product to accomplish the goals of this bill. And we say, you automatically get a waiver. You meet the criteria within the bill. Scenario B could be that the State Department of Education contracts with the college board, and District X comes to us and says, in 2004 and 2005, we had a contract with ACT. Would you consider us for a waiver? And we would be able to consider that and possibly grant them a waiver. We would not be required to grant them a waiver or whatever other circumstance they said to us.
For any reason. They just came to us and they said, we don't want to screw around with this next year. Leave us alone. Give us a waiver.
Right.
We would want language that would allow the board to give that waiver.
Representative Buckley, Representative Greenlake, I haven't been kicked under the table yet, so I feel like I'm doing pretty good. But I think that the test, they couldn't just come to us and say, we don't want to take the test. If they wanted a waiver, they would have to demonstrate that they had something that met the requirements laid out on page one of the bill, some sort of college testing implement that would meet the goals laid out on page one that the state contractor has to meet. So they couldn't just come to us and say, we don't want to do it because we don't want to do it, or, you know. So I'm going to stop now before I get kicked.
Thank you. Mr. Moore, can I bring up as an opinion?
Thank you, Chair Buckley. So the May, if we can pursue this just a little further, the May would be for 08-09 only?
Yes.
The shell is 06-07. The May is 08-09.
Representative Buckley, Representative Huffman, our interpretation is that the May and shell is still only for the 2008-2009 school year.
But the difference is that you'd have to do it the year before. Again, committee members, since this is it's a variation on what we've been discussing, I want to make sure that there's either a comfort level for or against it. Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The current dash-2 amendment is comfortable to me. Instead of a shell, that the May is more discretionary. In case there's something happen we don't see at this time, still the superintendent has the right to refuse something. You know, I think if we mandate shall, then we might have some more problem than May. So there's no reason why they shouldn't give the waiver if the requirement met, but at the same time, that the superintendent has the right to deny if there's something wrong. So to me, it's currently written, I'm comfortable more than shall.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Riemann.
If I can ask Morgan, you're talking about that authority under 2A, I think, right?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlake, yes.
So what we clearly wanted to say is the department may grant a waiver for 1 year under any conditions, but must grant it if it meets the criteria that are in...
I'm in
Q next. In this. I just found out what we're trying to achieve before I know whether I favor it or not.
I think the answer to that is no. That you can't say under any circumstances because the circumstances are described, the criteria
where?
Is described in...
Page one. But page one is around criteria about what the contractor needs to do. It isn't anything to do with criteria for what a school district should do. That's why I'm trying to find out where they see the authority for doing this.
I see we're getting it. Representative Compton, you want to weigh in?
My only comment is going to be very brief, Chair. We passed a bill last year, and it was a very clear bill. And the only thing that has been brought up since then is the request to grandfather school districts that are currently using an assessment in. After much duress and consideration, I said, okay, I do not like that proposal, but understanding with a short timeline, it's great for administrators and schools to have that extra timeline. Anything else is, I'm there. I'm done. It'll be a no vote.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cobb.
And I think two and A and B need to come out.
I was next.
Vice Chair Wisdom.
I agree with what she said.
and I think in order to achieve that, A and B need to come out, and our amended C does that. I mean, what? I guess it's C in the amendment, or is it B? What's the amendment? No, it's the B.
It's in B.
That's going to make a rule.
Yeah, I understand Representative Lim's point. I appreciate it. The desire for discretion, I think, is a positive aspect for doing most work that we're doing. However, we've gone around and around for this so much, I would have to be in agreement with my vice chairs that if we can just isolate it to the districts that have a contract in 2006 and 2007, which is what we discussed at the end of the session yesterday, I think that's the agreement the committee has.
And that'd be a must.
And that would be a must. So so I'm hoping that's clear. And
without A and B?
Yes,
I don't care what you take out. don't
let them think there's any other authority except that.
they get a waiver.
And that's a requirement, not an authority.
And if we can make the request to see how that drafts out in the text of the bill as a whole, that would be greatly appreciated. Representative Roland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If we do that, which I am in concurrence right now, I'm sounding pretty good about this too. The issue before in C, which was the shall part, was this 95%, which we, in this one, we're going to take that out.
Correct.
So I guess my only concern would be, what is the definition of contracted? Because most districts offer some of these tests to some of their kids, and sometimes they help with the payment because they have groups that say we'll help people that can't afford to take them. Just giving the test from my perspective, is not having contracted with them. Having contracted with them says the district is entered in with an agreement with a particular provider that they will provide X number of tests. It may be less than 95%, but they've contracted specifically for that test, as opposed to individual students signing up and doing it. And I think it should be the I just want to make sure that the definition of contracted is clear, so that we don't get into a misunderstanding of how many tests they had to take before they were contracted. I think that would be important. So if there is a definition of contracted, that would be helpful for me.
Or probably 20.
I know that's the problem with some of those words, and I don't want to get into a fight for the department when they have to sit there and say, well, one of our kids took this test when they were a sophomore last year, and therefore we contracted with them.
No.
And I don't want the department left in the lurch trying to figure out what that means when they're trying to decide if they have to give a waiver.
Chair.
That's your reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one issue that I think there's a lot of agreement up here, I'm sorry, Representative Lim, but how about the line 5? We've all agreed, too, that there's no funding. We're not going to address the funding issue based upon the excellent testimony we had yesterday.
Line 5.
Line 5 through 7.
I was going to say, you give any money if you have any money.
Okay. That would come out, wouldn't it, if A and B come out?
That's right here.
Yeah.
That's what we're. Yeah. That's our. That's
it was
question.
One of the discussions. Yeah.
That is.
You know, I would still like to include in that language, Mr. Chair.
Are you going to muddle this up again, Representative?
Yes, I am. Shall request a waiver. I mean, shall grant a waiver if requested. It seems to me if it's not there, this may require them to grant a waiver to every.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
To every. School
oh, okay.
District.
Even if they didn't request
that
it.
That does it, even if they don't want the waiver.
I like that.
We are drafting.
You are getting more and more lawyer-like as the session goes on.
Boy, when a health service researcher turns into a lawyer, we're in big trouble.
It's true. It is. It's very troublesome. Frankly, is that notation taken on that? Does anyone wish to discuss the issue that was brought up by Vice Chair Wisner in terms of the financing? Vice Chair Wisner is suggesting if we simplify this and take out allowing the school district to receive funding, that would simplify that. Representative Huffman?
Yeah, Chair Buckley, my understanding of a true Bennett bill, if I was listening yesterday, would take out funding. I mean, the funding wouldn't be an issue. It wouldn't be in there. That was my understanding.
That was the understanding that it was not an issue enough to hold anything back. I mean, basically take the funding out of the picture. Representative Roland.
One other suggestion is that could we say 07-08 instead of 06-07, because that's the just because they're doing it this year, and it's really those that we want to grandfather, not the ones that were taking it last year.
That is correct. This is why this is called a work session. That's exactly why. Vice Chair Cobb.
A point of order. If we had
there is no order.
if we would not have been amending this, then it would have been the appropriate terminology.
That's right. Thank you for that clarification, Vice Chair. Does our wonderful legislative council have a clear picture of what the desire
is? Point by point.
Give me your
so we're taking out A and B, C only. Looking at a possible definition for contracted to make it clear that it's not students individually going and taking a test. And we're going to say that the waiver is only if requested by the school district. It's not mandatory. And we're going to change the 2006 to 7 to an 07-08. Is that all sounding right?
Well, I'm not sure whether we're taking out A and B or not. I mean, I think we need to listen to what it is we're trying to achieve, and then you achieve it, however. Yeah. So there may be things in A and B that are necessary to achieve what the chair has just said is our objective, and so then they ought to be in there. I mean, I think our objective is what you said, A. Is it true the change of year, Mr. Chair?
It is true, because we are talking about that schools are, that are contracted, districts are contracting this year.
Yeah, that was the intent.
And must, asked. do it under those seasons.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And I'll ask
the committee members to look at A and B right now, 2A and 2B, and see if there's anything in those sections that anyone on the committee feels a need. We won't ask Mr. Bennett. He's already caused enough trouble. we'll just ask the members of the committee.
I think we can delete them, Mr.
Chair. I think so, too. Sorry I said no. I think they add confusion and ambiguity.
Very good. Looks like we
now,
have.
Does 4 go as well?
Well, you're really cleaning up.
He is cleaning up.
Well, if we're taking out the money, 4 okay. Talks about how you pay the money.
What else?
If we take enough out.
To the administration.
Don't need the bill anymore.
3 4.
Can I have a clarifying question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you can. And Representative Gillen brings up another good point. The committee could look at 3 and 4.
Mr. Chair, my question for the committee is by removing sections A and B, do you mean, because currently the dash 2s amend section B, which carries forward the purpose and criteria of the assessment, does the committee wish the waiver, which must be granted before a test that meets the purpose and criteria of the statewide assessment?
Yes. That those front criteria, they have to have a
and yes.
They have to be with some of those. So I agree with
that.
Thank
you for that clarification.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kremel.
So if we're taking out 2A, which is the funding piece, and we're taking out number four, and we're taking out sub 4 at line 18, we probably should go ahead and take out sub 3 at line, starting at line 15, because that's talking about how the department using money is available to, or is that a different pot of money that I'm looking at there, and does that need to stay in?
The administration, this section.
Funding to school districts that receive a waiver. Yeah, 3 goes.
To provide funding, because it says to provide funding to school districts that receive a waiver under this section, but the money's going away, so.
Right, but I think we can go away.
So that section can go
three
away.
And four go too.
3 and 4 go away.
So 3 and 4 go.
Representative Clem, you're not helping us here. I think a little assistance here.
He didn't get much sleep last night.
3 hours.
That's a fun one.
That's pretty good.
We're doing pretty good.
One point of clarification, Chair Buckley. Are we going to be tying this only to 2008-2009 still? The waiver's only for that 1 year?
Waiver's only for that 1 year, okay. And we'll have the joy if the committee desires to revisit this in January of 2009.
Only if not more fun than you
can. Oh, members are resigning from the committee in mass, it sounds like.
Wouldn't do that.
Any further comments for our life of the council besides to thank her for her patience and her consideration of the input from the committee?
Okay, you'll have a copy for tomorrow.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm going to try to review it tomorrow as well. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session. Members, thank you for your comments. Thank you for your patience as well. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 3600. I'd like to open up an informational meeting on the shared responsibility model.
Okay. Oh, we're done?
Okay. I'm going to clearly announce we are carrying over House Bill 3600 to Thursday, February 7th, 2008. And now we are in an informational meeting on the shared responsibility model. Thank you so much for coming to give us an update on this program.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margie Lau, Office of the Governor. We're glad to be here today to share with you our progress to date in terms of the implementation of House Bill 334, as I recall. Now I lose track of the numbers. But Dennis is going to lead off here with, and I'll talk about the outreach campaign.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, turn the switch.
It's switched to function FA.
Function FA.
There we go.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, you will be receiving a handout here, PowerPoint slides. They're a little bit small and hard to reach, or hard to read, rather. Or the print will be. So let me begin with the underlying assumptions of this program. As you will recall, this is an enormous investment for the state of Oregon. The funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant has climbed steadily in recent years from a level of $17 million or so to about $22 million, and then up to $33 million. Current year, we expect in the current academic year to spend about $34 million.
We have a not-to-exceed amount of $72 million for the academic year 08-09. So tremendous growth in this investment in our educational system, in our students in the state of Oregon. The basis for determining the amount of an opportunity grant becomes much more intricate, more complex, but it is based on a standard budget for each student, a standard amount for students in four-year schools, another standard amount for students in our two-year community colleges. You should note up front, those amounts are based on actual information from the Oregon Public Universities, actual information from our community colleges. The non-tuition amounts in these budgets, the amounts for living expenses, for books and supplies, that kind of thing, are based on data that we get from surveying the campuses annually, so they're annually updated. So starting with that cost of education and those two different variations, we have two more variations. There is the assumption of a student share that the student being the principal beneficiary of her or his education is the first to invest in that education. So we have a standard student share of $5,200 for students in community colleges, $8,200 for students in four-year institutions. And we derive that standard share, I'm just reviewing very quickly here, but from a reasonable expectation of work. The concern was that it was impossible to work your way through college any longer. It had just gotten too expensive in the state of Oregon. So with appropriate forms of assistance and then a reasonable estimate here, what could a student reasonably be expected to do? And we derive this in two ways, from working either 12 hours a week for 48 weeks out of the year, giving a few weeks off, or 15 hours a week during the academic year, and then, 12 hours a week during the academic year and full-time during the summer, or 15 hours a week for 48 weeks out of the year. The only differential there between community colleges and the four-year students is the expectation of borrowing. And you'll recall that right now, four-year graduates are borrowing over $19,000 on average. Well, we've made this a little bit more reasonable with a borrowing expectation of about $3,000 a year. For a four-year student, that would be a much more reasonable investment of $12,000, $12,000 indebtedness. And remember, these are standard amounts. No student has to borrow. No student has to work.
We were saying, I'm
sort
of getting confused.
Okay.
Let's take that $8,200.
Right.
That includes earnings and borrowing?
Correct.
And what would be the borrowing component of that?
$3,000. So that's the difference between the $5,200 at community colleges where they would not have a borrowing expectation.
And we're talking then about $100 a week over 52 weeks?
Very close to that, yes, right. We take the current Oregon minimum wage, the estimate of what a student can earn, take 90% of that to allow for withholding. The number of weeks, of course, is not complete 52 weeks, but that's how we divide the computation.
And this is something that would be at minimum wage.
Yes, and this would be reviewed and adjusted regularly in the future.
I understand.
So then the non-standard amount is the family share, and this is the EFC, stands for Expected Family Contribution. This is from the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or the FAFSA form that is required every year to apply for federal aid.
we at OSAC get all 160,000 of those forms every year, and out of those, maybe 110,000 or so are viable candidates for this grant. That means they are Oregon residents planning to attend an undergraduate program. They have remaining eligibility. They haven't received 4 years under this program already, and then they meet the program guidelines. So right now, this year, to refresh your memory, we're planning to assist around 27,000 of those students. Any way we look at it under this new methodology, we'll be helping 33,000 to 34,000. That's a third or more of the viable candidates for the program. The federal share, then, calculated from that FAFSA form, the Pell Grant, and then a standard expectation for tax credits. There are two main tax credit programs right now, the HOPE tax credit and the Lifelong Learning tax credit. They kick in at different income levels for different types of students. So we have six different family types. We have six different schedules of kind of a fair expectation on a tax credit. We have an actual dollar amount on the Pell Grant. We subtract all those items out, and we have remaining need. And if we had a fully funded program, we would know what the state share would be then. Since we can't afford that in the coming year, we have a pro rata reduction. And that reduction is calculated by multiplying a percentage against the result that we have there. You can imagine if you multiply anything times zero, you still have zero. So the highest need students do not have a reduction or don't have any kind of a pro rata consideration here. For a family that has a $1,000 EFC, and if we had a pro rata reduction of 20%, that would be a 1,200 EFC that we would be subtracting from the budget. Right now, the pro rata reduction that we're using is 0.19, and we'll show you how that works in just a moment. The opportunity grant award amount then, after we've taken out the reduction, is what we are projecting, what we estimate. And again, if we had full funding, we wouldn't have to put caps on this program. But the caps right now, $2,600 at the community college level and $3,200 at the four-year level, they're close to double what the grant was. The maximum grant was, and it was an all-or-nothing grant just a year ago. So tremendous improvement. The cost controls, just for review then.
Hold on a second, Representative Greenland?
Yes, sir.
Very interesting, and I'm very glad to hear that. I have some other questions, but I thought we had come out with a place where we were assuring students that if they worked the expected amount of time, borrowed the expected amount of money, and had their family provide the expected amount of money into it, that they would be assured that their college education was going to be paid for at a state school. I take it that is not the case in this.
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlee, I wish we had the adequate funding. It would take another $30 to $40 million for this coming year to be able to fund the program at that level.
That's not the issue. The issue is we really can't go on telling students, I think what I've been telling them, in fact, that I thought I heard, that once we work this out, I heard the governor say they would know exactly how much they had to contribute, and they would know exactly how much their family had to contribute, and then they would know that for their whole 4 years of school. I think we've got to, I mean, if that's not what we can tell people anymore, because there's the pro rata share, we don't know what that's going to be, there's the cap, we don't know what that's going to be, we're sort of selling this in a strange way, and I think at least I'm going to be a lot more careful about it.
Please do. Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, yes, we have had
to. I did hear the governor say that, didn't I?
You heard the governor say when it's fully funded, and he fully intends that it will be in the 09-11 biennium. At this point, we're saying the aid has grown tremendously. We're not there yet. We encourage everyone to apply to see if they're going to be eligible, and the aid will be higher than what it's ever been in the past, and more families will be eligible than have ever been in the past, but we are not yet at the full implementation of the model.
Do
So if I could follow up on that, when we're at the full implementation of the model, will it still be the roughly the same debt load for for students?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, you are, excuse me,
Schizophrenics.
Yes, we are expecting the same borrowing level for students at that $3,000 without a borrowing expectation for students at the community college.
Okay, thank you.
Of course, we'll need to update all of the factors because Oregon's minimum wage will change, the cost of attendance will change, but right now, the Student Assistance Commission staff have done projections saying, here's what the cost would be if all of those parameters remained the same. And that comes in at a little bit more than $100 million at full implementation.
Thank you, Representative Greenick.
Yes, and you talked about eligibility criteria. And I had a wail from community college students in the Rockford campus in my district that they were told they were no longer eligible for the opportunity grant if they were a part-time student. I told them that couldn't possibly be true. They had to be wrong.
And you were exactly right, Representative Greenlick.
I thought that was the
part-time
misunderstood
students,
something.
Yes, there was
some piece of this.
There was a mix-up in some of the communication.
Good.
Part-time students are still eligible for awards. The Student Assistance Commission made a slight change in policy to simplify the process in January so that part-time student awards are exactly 50% of what that same student in that same financial condition would be eligible as full-time.
That's right. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my issue, and I'd like just to make sure people understand, if you choose to take advantage of our community college system, then the amount of debt at the end of the 4 years is only $6,000, not 12. Much better than it would be if you chose to go the four-year way the whole time. So, I mean, I think students have to make those choices for themselves to see what kind of debt load they have. So, you mentioned the $12,000, and I just want to make sure that a number of students recognize that this is really a $6,000 obligation if I'm willing to do the other stuff.
And to make the point, Representative Roebling, a student could actually also work additional hours than what
that's
the
true, and not have that.
And also have a slightly, hopefully, maybe higher pay. Representative Kremel, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Dennis, twice I heard you say, well, if it were fully funded. And I think there are some of us that were under the impression that by getting to the $104 million that we did last, or $106 million that we did for the biennium, that was fully funding. So if that's not fully funding, how much is it? I mean, you know, now I heard you here a few minutes ago say something about, well, 30 to 40 million, you know. I don't want, you know, yeah, you know, well, a couple million here and a couple million there, and like Senator Dirksen used to say, you know, pretty soon you're talking real money. How much does it take? I mean, how much are we expecting to pay for students to go to college? How much are we expecting that this is going to, you know, I mean, if $106 million isn't enough for this biennium, then why weren't we told that last year? And if it's not enough, then I want to know what is the amount that is enough. Because the other thing I want to know, because if I remember correctly last year, during the regular session, you came in and told us that you hadn't given away all of the money that was earmarked to be given away. So either it was enough or it wasn't. If it wasn't enough, then how much are all of those dollars going to be actually given away? Because I absolutely refuse to vote for this to go in and create and support a bureaucracy. If it's not going to the students, I'm off of it because that's where the money is supposed to go. So how much is full funding? How much does it take to get there? And I think then coming into the 09 session, Mr. Chair, it is incumbent upon them to, number one, tell us, yep, by golly, we gave it all away. It's all gone. Number two is that it's going to cost this amount of money if you want it fully funded. And be straight about the number and be on the number instead of this, well, you know, $30-40 million. And that was not, and now we're 6 months after we closed out the last, well, 7 months after we closed out the last session. So how much is it?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kremel, very good point, and I can explain. First of all, the $106 million is $34 million for the current academic year and $72 million for the 08-09. Now, That is with these cost controls in place, and that was clearly explained in all the hearings as we went along, that we didn't think the state of Oregon could afford a fully funded model. If we take all of these controls off, all we're doing right now is taking them off our projections. The scenario shows that then it grows to between 103 and 109 million, depending on, you know, minor fluctuations in student behavior. But a fully funded program then would be at about that level. It takes another 30 million or so. As to the last session...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Per year?
Per year. That's correct.
Mr. Chair,
because I think we were under the impression that this was a good amount for the biennium.
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I was doing the work with the legislative fiscal staff and with members throughout the session using the model that had been built for us by the Western Interstate Compact on Higher Education. And very early on, it was clear, and I made very clear in all of my presentations to all those Ways and Means committees, that we were putting in place rationing tools in order to make sure that we could stretch the dollars that the committee had identified to fit the need. The committee had many demands in terms of where it needed to place its resources, and so we were very clear as we communicated with the committee on how we would approach making sure that we were funding the students with the greatest need, with the greatest awards, but still making sure that we were going to make to serve additional students. And you know, I've got reams of information in my office, and I'm sure you do in your legislative records, that also reflect that. You know, as we move forward, right now one of the things we have to remember is the current year we're operating the old program. The new shared responsibility model doesn't go into effect until the next academic year, starting next fall. And that's the reason why you see such a large change between the $33 million presently to the $72 million. We are doing, and one of the slides will get to that, a lot of work to make sure that every corner of this state and every student in this state is aware of this program and has access to go and find out what the resources it may provide to them. Like, I'm just back from Southern Oregon last night doing editorial board visits, talking with people in chambers of commerce, visiting campuses, and we're doing that all across the state. In addition to that, you know, we'll get to that slide, but there's a lot of work going on. There's also TV and radio spots in English and Spanish, trying to make sure that families are aware of this new benefit. Posters, pamphlets have gone to every school, many community agencies. There's a lot of work, and we're doing anything we can to complement the work that you may be doing as well.
So to just emphasize, and Representative Crummell, I'll let you follow up if you'd like to, but emphasize, when our committee heard about this bill during session, we were hearing about the model that was being put in place, and at least two of the members had in their minds that model was going to be to fully fund, you know, this program, but the Ways and Means Committee did struggle with how that model could be used, given existing resources, but that was clear to the Ways and Means Subcommittee and the Ways and Means Committee as a whole, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, I guess just as a comment, so let's say 110 million, we'll just round up a million, you know, it's only $1 million, right? So next year, what we should anticipate seeing then, as a body and in the Ways and Means process, is that you're going to come in with a request for $220 million for the biennium. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, we will update all of the factors in the model. We need to coordinate it with the decisions that we're making in terms of the higher education tuition assumptions. But yes, you will see a proposal from the governor that fully funds both years of the biennium, this program.
In his budget.
That's what I wanted to know.
Here's that club.
I didn't think it was possible for my blood pressure to get elevated over this issue anymore now that I'm father. But it did a little bit, not nearly as much as it usually does. Sure. I just want to take the opportunity once again for the record to establish that the reason there were unexpended funds from the Opportunity Grant was because the legislature placed a budget note that told the commission you cannot change your hydraulics around. So you cannot spend your extra $14 million you discovered via a budget note. I was at the committee. I was not a legislator at the time. I was the chair of the commission. I got up and I said, this is a horrible mistake. Do not put a budget note on the budget because if we have more money, we can't spend it. And they did it anyway, and the money went unspent. But it had nothing to do with the commission. It was entirely the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee in 2005.
Thank you, Representative Wilden.
And it not only did it have no issue with the commission, it also had no indication as to the need out there and how many kids could have been available to accept that money had the parameters been allowed to go down a little bit so you could pick up a few of those people. So it was not just that there weren't people out there to give it to either, and I want to make sure that people realize that there were needy students.
Truthfully, they were trying to control costs. It wasn't the other way around. It was that they thought there was not going to be enough, so they didn't want us creating hydraulics freeing up more obligation for the state. It just turned out it went the wrong way, but the budget note was not flexible in that regard.
Vice Chair Phil.
Well, my learnings are in the past 2.5 years and part of this body is now when you do a budget note like that, Representative, say that if there are any additional funds remaining, that they can only be spent in higher ed.
I was for no budget note myself. I wasn't the legislator. I didn't even get a vote.
I've been here 3 terms. I can't figure out the whole business of budget note.
Mr. Chair, continue, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving along. This is a little hard to read. This is what I alluded to earlier. In front of you, easier to read on the screen, perhaps, but only perhaps. This is a graphic presentation of what we presented last spring and summer when we were running various scenarios. At the top, we look at the budgets that I talked about, the average tuition and fees in public four-year schools and in community colleges, then the recognized non-tuition expenses, and the student shares that we talked about, the attendance factor that Ms. Lau mentioned, 1.0 for full-time, 0.5 for half-time. Technical terms like pickup rates are how many students do we expect to use this during the year, and then the full-time, half-time splits are based on student behavior in the various sectors. You can recall the award cap, of course, and then the attendance adjustment is where we adjust for the student behavior that is unpredictable. Being students, they will go full-time one term, half-time the next, and disappear for spring quarter.
Or their share stays the same?
I'm sorry?
When they're full or half-time, it looks like if my eyes are right, that their share stays the same whether they're full or half-time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, yes, we start with that full-time budget, but then we ration the award down later for half-time.
It says student share.
In the center part?
The second box, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee.
Student share. It says full-time 82, I think. Half-time 82.
That's correct, but then the attendance factor reduces the award by 0.5.
Mr. Chair,
it reduces the net award.
Correct.
But the net award came about by including the student share. Right. That was one of the subtractions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, the way in which the formula now works, given the commission's policy change in January, they calculate the award as if the student were a full-time student, assuming that same work level, effort, and borrowing. And then if they're a part-time student, that number is just divided by 2, and they get half of that amount.
Yeah, the net number. But the net number comes about by subtracting some numbers. And if you subtract the full-time workload and the full-time share, then the net number you divide in half is smaller. If you say the student share should be 8,200 for full-time and 4,100 for half-time, that would change the bottom number that you then cut in half. Right? Wouldn't it? I mean, you had all those minuses up in that first chart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, they assume the student's costs are the same as if they were full-time and that their contribution is if they were full-time.
Okay.
So it's as if they were a full-time student, and then you just
both times,
divide by 2.
It's that doctors and math thing.
I know. It's a problem. I'm acting like a doctor now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the other items, which may be hard for you to read on those handouts, but on the screen, we've mentioned the EFC adjustment. The income cap. The next one, the Pell Grant maximum, because this model is dependent on federal funding, and the federal estimate was, the federal government itself was estimating a maximum grant of $4,800 as recently as last November. When the final numbers came in, kind of at the end of the calendar year, lo and behold, a $69 decrease in that maximum award. And then also the federal Pell Grant, which had had a minimum of $400 for many years, went up to $890, and we lost some awards at both ends. So back to the drawing board. We redid the projections, and this is what we are working with right now. The total opportunity grant expenditures that you see under estimated results down there, $71,864,961. That's well within the $72 million that we have available. My only caveat is that we have something called grandfathering, and we will have some grandfathered awards. We are taking all of this into account, and should we go over that $72 million and have to come back at some point, if it looks like we're going to go over, it would be, we hope, in the spring or the summer, we would also come back with a plan for where we expect those funds to come from. For us, right now at least, what we've been logging in as lottery income, it's been ahead of projections for this biennium. They may taper off, that may be different, but we would either make adjustments in the effective or expected family contribution, the pro rata, and students who apply later get proportionately less, or we would be seeking additional funds if we needed a few hundred thousand dollars more to meet obligations under this plan. So what are we doing to change student behavior? Well, first of all, as of this morning, we have received 38,813 FAFSA forms so far. Now, this is only 1 month into the calendar year, and this is students applying for next September. Remember, I said that universe will grow to about 110,000 over the next 16 months or more. Right now, 38,000 of them. Of those, we have sent email messages to 16,141 students saying it appears you are eligible. Those messages also tell students you need to contact the campus that you're interested in. We link to every campus's, or every college and university website so that if they want to fill out an application online, they can do that. Over the weekend and through yesterday, we were doing a lot of training with financial aid administrators from around the state. They held their state conference in Eugene. And what we're finding is that the students are getting the email messages, and they're coming into the aid offices, and many of the aid office personnel are complaining. We're getting lots more phone calls. We're getting lots more traffic, people asking what they need to do, and my reaction is, exactly. That's what we hoped. We want them to do that. Being students, of course, they will come in with questions that are answered in the email, or they could follow the link. They could get their own estimate. They don't need go to the aid office. But by having that contact, they're learning what they need to do to finish an admissions process or to finish up on the financial aid award if another piece of information is needed by that office. Would you like to take over on the marketing?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we began a process last November with the governor doing kind of a cross-state visit to announce the fact that we created this online calculator that students and families can go to and input information for describing a variety of different circumstances and then see what kind of information it says in terms of the amount of aid that their students and their family might be eligible for. We followed that up with visits to numerous editorial boards across the state. I think at this point we've covered 15 different newspapers and communities across the state and are still underway in terms of meeting with additional ones. The weather is giving us a few challenges in many places these days. I think we're trying to schedule Astoria now for the third time because it seems to be in a very precarious part of the state's geography this particular year. In addition to that, Brochures and posters have been mailed to every high school and college campus in the state with information about the Opportunity Grant and the website for where they can both apply for broader financial aid information, but also use the calculator. In addition to that, training has been given to counselors, both admissions staff and high school counselors, as Dennis said, also to all of the school financial aid offices. And beyond that, we're doing a number of different outreach to particularly underrepresented communities in our higher education system. Outreach to the African American community, the Latino community, rural communities, places where we know that our college attendance rate lags that of the average for the state, to make sure that they're also aware. Because one of the things that we've heard in some of the work that the State Board of Higher Education has been doing is that for many of these students, the reason why they don't go to school is the financial constraints that they have. In addition to that, on February 27th, OPB is going to run a half an hour program that will be broadcast across the state about college financial aid, including information about the Opportunity Grant. They'll be taping next week some promo parts of that, including the governor, that they'll be running in advance of the program, encouraging families to tune in to learn about the program. And then we're doing some partnering with a young man who's a native Oregonian from South Eugene, who describes himself, he's written a couple of books, as the scholarship coach. He's having a large college financial aid and admissions outreach event at the Portland Convention Center on April 20th. And he's working with us on doing the marketing, so we're going to partner with him on his event. And he's also helping us reach out to these underrepresented communities.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentations. A couple questions. Confirm for me, is part-time community college people eligible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, yes, definitely. Part-time, half-time, they must take at least 6 credits. Between 6 and 11 is considered half-time, and they are eligible.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Bob.
Representative Comp and Mrs. Richardson and myself attended a seminar in Denver, and one of the big resources that we need for our workforce development is college dropouts. So in your effort to get the notice out there to people about this opportunity now that we're funding, are you trying, I would encourage you, and would like you to report back to me or give me a phone call or something, how you're, if you're attempting to reach college dropouts to complete their programs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we couldn't agree more. Part of the message that we share with every editorial board we visit with is that this program has no age barrier for eligibility. You can be 17, 27, or 57. If you don't yet have a bachelor's degree and haven't used your prior 4 years of eligibility, you can go to school with this grant today. We're also doing outreach to the Department of Human Services. We're doing training for their casework staff, and we hope to be able to reach out to places like the food bank system and many of our less traditional partners, so that we can make sure that those people are also aware of affordability for education now.
Just one comment there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's February the 13th at 6:30, so I would encourage the Oregon Student Association to attend a presentation that Mrs. Richardson is organizing about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it's on our calendars. We expect to be here.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Vice Chair. I was going to ask a question in terms of the community college part-time students. I received a letter from Portland Community College several weeks back, and perhaps the January fix addressed this. But in terms of the numbers of students eligible for a part-time financial assistance, do we have those numbers comparing this current academic year with the next academic year? Are we going to increase the number of part-time students available for assistance at the community college level?
Chair Buckley, hard to read on what you have. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little easier to read on the screen. You see an estimate there for part-time students in the community college sector, 4,198 we're estimating under the new scenario. Total of 5,152 part-time students that we estimate for the 08-09 year. We have about 3,900 part-time students right now in the program. So this is, any way you look at it, an increase, and it's certainly an increase in the community college sector. The earlier way, the way the program had originally been designed, would have cut into that, and it by no means cut off half-time eligibility. It did shrink the number of eligible students. The steering committee, the commission, responded, acted. We had recommended a number of fixes, and it was a very straightforward change made then in December, implemented in January.
I appreciate that very much, and I assume you've communicated to the community colleges this information.
Mr. Chair, definitely. It's always fun to communicate good news like that.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Margie, do you see colleges coming to you asking for information? Do you see them proactive in promoting this and using it as a marketing tool, if you will, to try to attract more students to their facility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I think we have kind of a foot race going on amongst all of our various colleges trying to see who can woo the most students to their programs. And, that is complemented by actions that are taken on part of both how the funds are being distributed by the State Board of Higher Education and amongst the community colleges, where they are very much enrollment-based. So the greater they can raise their enrollments, and that's a matter of new admissions plus retention, the stronger their tuition revenue is going to be, but also the stronger their state support is going to be.
Follow-up, please. So are we tracking okay to be giving the money away for this year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, we're challenged by the fact that the Student Assistance Commission in the past has not kept records of how many applications they would have received for aid this early in the process before, because in the past their tracking was more a matter of trying to monitor how soon they needed to establish the cutoff dates. We no longer have to operate with cutoff dates, but rather we're trying to figure out how well is our outreach program going. We don't have any benchmarks to compare against, but we're very excited. As I'm out in communities, as I'm talking with people from across the state, I'm hearing people saying that they've heard the ads, they've seen the stories in the newspapers. So I think we're getting good coverage. The part we don't know is how it's going to translate into changes in admissions.
Follow up, Chair Buckley. Do you have a date certain to check back and go, okay, we're lagging, let's reinforce advertising or whatever to make sure that the funds are produced this year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, our direct dollars that we have for advertising are limited, and we're even in a little bit of a discussion in terms of some folks understood that some of the dollars that were in the budget that we saw as for broad implementation, they instead interpreted as being for just simply the mechanical side of the implementation in terms of the awarding methodology and programming. So we are spending dollars that we're still in negotiation with some of our partners to say that we can spend this $200,000 that we are using for the outreach campaign right now. We think we'll get that all ironed out, hopefully even in the next week or so. We're also looking at developing a longer-term marketing effort for this, and we're fortunate that there's a new federal grant that will give us some resources to do that so we don't have to take dollars away from actual student services to do so.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. I think I know the answer to this based on the challenge that you're working with on the $200,000. But so there was, I'm assuming, no opportunity for community college or university to apply for a $5,000 advertising grant out of this fund to market the program on their own?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, no, that wasn't the case. Instead, what we've done is tried to partner with all of those institutions by providing them with camera-ready materials that they can include in all of their publications for their own outreach. I'm hoping for the day that the Opportunity Grant is on the back cover of those quarterly course offering catalogs that go out to every household across the state, because that's going to do a lot to increase the awareness for the program.
There's an agreement.
Yeah,
I've been trying to work with some numbers here, doing my story problems. So. Just to find out what the implications of that pro rata share and the cap is. And if I'm looking at the numbers correctly, you're saying it's about $16,000 for the cost of a full-time student on that. The eye test is working better today. And if a student was to put in $8,200, the maximum expectation of the students, and they got the maximum Pell Grant, assume if they were to get the maximum Pell Grant, the assumption is that they wouldn't have family resources to put into it. That comes out with a net of $3,100 before the pro rata share. The pro rata share relates to that, and I have the same figures for a full family. The pro rata share, you say, okay, you need $3,100, but we won't give you $3,100. We give you 80% of that. Is that what the 0.19 pro rata share is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, it isn't as drastic a reduction as that. For that full need student, that's a zero EFC, or expected family contribution.
Right.
There would be no reduction, so that student would get the maximum.
And it would be inside the cap.
Yes.
Because the cap was 32, so for that student, it would be inside the cap. Let's take the family with a maximum contribution, which I assume is about 20%, from your tables. Is that a maximum or an average?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake.
Your table that cannot be read as under EFC adjustment 19%, 0.19, so that would make me think roughly 20% of the total cost, of the overall cost, right? 20% of the 16,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, no, that is not a percentage of the cost. It's a percentage of what the family can be expected to contribute. So if the need analysis calculates the family
at
1,000,
I got you.
It would be an increase of 190 then for that family.
Real quick comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Reference that seminar again. It was about putting out college graduates, and Oregon had an F, as most states did have an F of the states that were there. But they did recognize our shared responsibility model and how that was. They were going to be looking at that, and that was good. We were happy to be patted on the back for that.
Very good.
Good.
We have a fun.
Wish you luck.
Further questions?
Thank you very much. I have one fundamental question. This $108 million in biennium, and do you use any expenses out of it? But 100% goes to strictly for the students' scholarships, whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, the dollars that you're seeing there are simply they're strictly the grant award dollars. In addition to that, the Student Assistance Commission has some portions of around 5 FTE who are involved in the making sure that the computer systems work and that the policies are kept up to date and that they're tracking what our utilization rate is. That's going to be a very important factor for the governor and for this legislative body, that we know as early as possible next fall what the usage rate is for the grants, because that's going to be key to us in terms of understanding how those dollars are going to stretch through the rest of this biennium and what the cost needs to be that goes into that 09-11 budget proposal from the governor.
Okay.
So a very efficient staff. We're partnering very well, as you can see, I out of the governor's office, folks out of the community colleges and workforce development and their association, and people out of the university system, the Oregon University system. Their communications office has done phenomenal work to help support this. And as you can see now, Oregon Public Broadcasting. So we're working with partners, public and private, across the state.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Mr. You want to respond?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the only thing I would point out in addition on this changing student behavior is that Ms. Lauer has been working on some of the very visible things. The invisible things are the advising and the mentoring that is happening on those 100 12 high school campuses right now where we have Aspire programs where people are working one-on-one with students. College School Oregon, at the bottom of the page, occurred on January 26th. A year ago, we started this program, and we had 15 sites around the state, kind of a blitz effort to help families fill out that onerous FAFSA form. It's worse than a 1040, believe me. And many, many people, not just people who don't have post-secondary education, many, many people require help filling out that form. This year, we had 20 sites, so we were up from 15. Most of them are on community college campuses. We helped over 2,000 families fill out that form and get it submitted that day. Extremely rewarding work. We had Spanish interpreters and translators on a number of the sites, especially in urban centers. This is tremendous growth from 900 some families last year to more than 2,000 this year. We don't have the final statistics, but already we're over that. And this is the kind of grassroots stuff happening on high school campuses, on community college campuses all over the state. Already, to answer a question that Representative Huffman raised, we have close to 39,000 of those FAFSA forms in our office. That we don't calculate, we didn't calculate a year ago what we would be getting in January. But by March, we will have about half the number that we will get for a whole year. And that's consistent across more than a decade. In other words, a universe of 110 potentially viable candidates, we're going to have about half of whatever that total is in March. It varies from just over 100 to maybe 112 or 114. So you can tell that's pretty consistent over time. We're on track to be way, way over last year's level. So if we need to make adjustments later on, if we can't sustain this level of awarding, we'll know. We'll have indicators that everybody's up. The traffic in FAFSAs, the traffic in college admission and financial aid offices, we'll know, I think. This email is changing behavior as much as anything. Students wouldn't have found out in past years until they got a financial aid award. And that doesn't come until late spring or early summer sometimes. So you would fill out that onerous form I told you about and somehow get your family through that process, and you wouldn't hear until you got an aid award. And that is assuming then that you had already finished the admission process, can be pretty daunting in itself, and gotten everything else submitted, you know, maybe a 1040 or a copy of other information that had to be sent into the financial aid office. Now what we're doing is front-ending that. We're telling students it looks like you're eligible, and we're directing them via that link in red to the estimator. The estimator works very simply, very straightforward way. There's a welcome page. You select an academic year, and we need to know a few basic things about you, but in five screens, we can find out what type of student you are. If you filled out that FAFSA form, we have your adjusted gross income, that kind of thing. We can then estimate, and this is what's changing behavior more than anything, the amount of an opportunity grant and the amount of the student's federal Pell Grant. What was really rewarding at College Bowl, Oregon, was to sit down with a student or a family, take them through the FAFSA form, then take them to the estimator, and show them in January what they might be able to expect in the fall. Now, this is all depending on data that they've told us about. You know, they can change it when they file their taxes in the spring, but in most cases, they don't change very much for lower-income families. Even for middle-income families, they're pretty consistent if they're wage earners. So they can count on this. We saw lots of tears. We saw lots of people just overjoyed because they now have a possibility that they didn't have before. So calling attention to this, getting people into the process, all that's important. But what we do with them once they fill out that form is equally as critical. And we're working at both ends. The training that we've been doing most recently over the weekend with the financial aid staff.
Can you go back one? I sure can. Representative Greenlick, Representative Huffman, and then I'll get back to you. That student would never have been eligible for an opportunity grant before because their income for the family was too high. A family size, $45,000, never. So for those of you who believe of the, you know, the cliff where middle class or just barely over sort of lower levels could never get financial aid because they were a dollar over with our new sloped formula, they're getting a $1,500 grant, which was pretty much the max award for the poorest of the poor. They would have gotten zero in the past without this model. Amazing. Things have gone a lot better since I left.
It actually follows up pretty much on what Representative Clem has just been talking about. I gotten a little familiar with the FAFSA form since I had four grandkids, one in college, two this year and two 3 years ago. And I was intrigued with the fact that in one of my grandkids was going to a private school. The tuition was $42,000, $43,000. And the form for their family, which includes two school teachers, indicated that the family could afford to contribute $30,000 a year, which seemed sort of amazing for the family and to me. But if that comes out on this calculation, and the tuition, the costs are $16,000, then the assumption would be they wouldn't be eligible for any of these because the family contribution would be greater than the tuition. I mean, what came off the FAFSA form would indicate, or is it different depending on the school they're going to in this contribution? I mean, is it the fact that they're going to a $40,000 school what made that high? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, you know, we tease apart the parent contribution and the student contribution. Those are two factors that are combined on the federal form for that expected family contribution. But the student contribution is now coming out of the student share. And so that's a different formula based on how we're working here in Oregon now.
But it would still be, you know, take the $8,000 out of the $30,000, it would still be $22,000. Would that mean they'd be essentially ineligible for aid in a state school in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, two things could be operating here. For one thing, many high-priced schools, and you've defined one there, do have their own systems of need analysis and put their own expectations on families. Now, that can work for better or for worse. As you've been hearing, some of the Ivy League schools and very well-endowed schools have been taking families like the one you see illustrated up here and saying, we're not going to expect any loan of a family like that with an income of only $45,000 or so. So in that case, you know, a well-endowed institution, they're under the spotlight right now. They've been raising their tuition so fast and their costs are soaring so high that they've had to do something. Now, on the other side of it, they often will take the need analysis calculation and adjust it. They will make more of an expectation than we would normally do in a standard way here. They'll say, we know we're expensive, but if they don't have the endowment or the means of meeting those expenses, they'll whittle down the need and the aid award will look different. So I've seen both. And unless I knew the individual family circumstances and the school and the budget and everything, I couldn't
give you this number like in the 45 to 60,000 gross adjusted, students will be expecting to get aid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, yes, with an income cap of $70,000, we are reaching some of those families.
We have about 1 minute left to go to the Huffman Head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Buckley. I was just going to submit that the tears were probably for the fact that they were finished with the paperwork. And it does, I commend you, it sounds like that you are trying to simplify at least part of the process and get it online and have a few pages and simplify that. And I commend the program. I just wish it had been a number of years ago. Most of my kids got out with double the debt that you're projecting here, at least. So at least we're headed in the right direction, it seems like.
Thank you, Representative. Any closing thoughts?
Just one last comment. I would encourage all of you and your colleagues to include that web link, getcollegefunds.org, in your newsletters and any communications you have with your constituents. You can help us get the word out.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your time today. Greatly appreciate it. Members, before we adjourn, our administrator does have some handouts for you that she wants to make sure you get before we leave. Again, thank you for your time, consideration, and efforts this afternoon, and we'll see you tomorrow at 1:00.